Committee on Rules. I hope everyone had a delightful 4th of July holiday and that your ears aren't too buzzing too loudly from all the fireworks. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2450. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Madam Speaker, do you want to come on up? Sarah Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2450B directs the Legislative Assembly to appropriate to the K-12 school fund budget an amount equal to 51% of projected personal income tax revenues beginning with the 2007-2009 biennium.
Good morning, Madam Speaker. Welcome.
Good morning. I've asked Senator Gordley just to begin, if that's okay with
that's
you.
That's fine.
And then I'll follow her. Thank you very much, and good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Hope you all had a restful 4th of July weekend and time spent with family. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, I'm Abel Gordley, representing Senate District 23, which includes wonderful neighborhoods in Northeast and Southeast Portland. And what I want to do this morning, I thought I was going to modify this testimony from that which I gave over on the House side when I spoke in support of the Speaker's bill, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go ahead and share the length of the testimony that I provided then, because I want you, my colleagues, to have a better sense, greater sense of what it is, of what the experiences have been that bring me to support the measure before you. And I am a little out of breath this morning because I just stepped out of a car and raced up the stairs to get here. Again, I want the committee to know something about my perspective, which stems from my career as an education activist, spanning more than 25 years, advocating for a quality, non-racist education for all children, all students. And I also want to say that I've served in this legislature since 1991. And I am like many of you, like all of you, very tired of watching things not happen in this building, that I am tired of things not happening around education funding and bringing stability to funding. And I'm frankly very, very tired of the partisan obstructionism that gets in the way of doing what is right for Oregon and what is needed for Oregonians. And I do hope that we will look at the bill before us on its merits. On its merits. On its merits. As a product of Oregon schools and as an involved adult, I can tell you that our schools have historically left many children behind, particularly the children of the poor, children of color, and the disabled. And long before there was a program or a mandate called No Child Left Behind, I was among those advocating for those children so that none would be left behind, so that all would receive a meaningful, relevant, quality education, no matter if they lived in an urban community, a rural community, and that there would be, and I was working with many, many others to remove the excuses. No more excuses. No child left behind. Beginning in 1979, along with other members of the Black United Front and the Urban League, I fought for disaggregated data at the district level in Portland Public Schools to be used as a diagnostic tool, and then took this fight to the state level once I became a legislator, working with then Superintendent Stan Bunn to achieve this level of reporting, again disaggregated data, And again, this was before the federal requirement of No Child Left Behind. Without this data, again, a diagnostic tool which clarifies achievement gap issues, Oregon would continue to pursue one-size-fits-all strategies that leave children behind by design. In the late 70s and early 80s in Portland, I helped organize school boycotts and coordinated hundreds of volunteers, students, parents, to address issues of fiscal and what we then called multicultural accountability. It's become something else now known as cultural competency. I worked with many others to coordinate a Saturday school program focused on reading and math and bringing African American history and culture to students. And this was a program based in several neighborhood churches. I served for more than 5 years on the Portland Public Schools Desegregation Monitoring and Advisory Committee and was vice chair of its curriculum committee. And I've also worked as a parent coordinator for Albina Head Start. Why am I laying out these experiences for you? So that you have a sense of, again, the history that has brought me to this table at this moment. And so that you, frankly, have a sense of what are the credentials I bring to talk about this issue. And in this way, I was the author of Oregon's Multicultural Curriculum Act of 1999, which requires Oregon school districts to develop and implement a multicultural curriculum policy. For the past decade, with others, I have led the statewide effort to improve and enhance the quality of public and private teacher education programs to reflect the increasing diversity of Oregon and to achieve a standard of cultural competency for all educators. I support the policy of No Child Left Behind, and most of the mandates having to do with support for low-performing schools, particularly the mandate calling for disaggregated data. Without No Child Left Behind, we would have status quo. Very clear about that. Without No Child Left Behind, we would have status quo, and that is unacceptable. Until very recently, the education establishment and its leadership as we know it in Oregon had failed Oregon's poor white students and its students of color by not providing aggressive, no excuses leadership to close the achievement gap and to close the teaching gap. That leadership gap, thankfully, is starting to close. And I'm pleased to report to the committee that these past failures are being successfully addressed now under the leadership of Superintendent Susan Castillo, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and their director, Vicki Chamberlain, and key organizations such as the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, the Oregon School Board Association, the Northwest Regional Laboratory, and most recently, the Oregon Education Association has become more assertive in its understanding of what needs to happen differently if we're going to leave no child behind. These education leaders, many are here in this hearing room today, are depending on us. They are depending on you at this point in the process to find a solution that reaches beyond our current funding crisis and addresses the future educational needs of our state. We legislators, we Oregonians, cannot solve our education funding problems. And for that matter, we cannot solve any significant Oregon problem without a comprehensive bipartisan strategy, and that's why I am here today. My support for this measure has not been bought or traded, and I did not consider the Portland provision, which is no longer in the bill, to be blackmail. I am very much aware that Portland tax dollars subsidize the rest of the state. And I hope that we all recognize and respect that. But I am here because I refuse to stay stuck in partisan limbo. That is a choice, and that's why I'm here. We are meeting this morning at 9:16 on the 5th of July as the 2005 Legislative Assembly draws to a close, and as school districts across the state have already passed out pink slips to teachers. We know that we're facing more crowded classrooms next year. We know that we have students from poor families who are facing a summer without the school lunch program they have depended on to keep body and soul together. I hope we passed out that free lunch program.
It came out of the Senate, Senator Hordley.
And so we have, as we speak this morning, students in some areas of our state who also have struggled with a four-day school week, and we know that that will be the case for them next year as well. I'm here today to say that we legislators and all Oregonians must put our partisan differences aside and stand together for our children and for the future of the state, and I'm willing to do that. And I really hope that this does not come across as lecturing or being patronizing. I am just trying to do the very best that I know how to speak what is in my head and what is in my heart. And I'm trying to do that prayerfully as well. I'm here to support House Bill 2450 because it offers an opportunity for this legislature to forge a comprehensive bipartisan strategy to address the funding, quality and equity issues that plague Oregon's education system and Oregon's economy. I am here to advocate for adequate, stable funding for Oregon's full educational spectrum, from pre-kindergarten programs to higher education, for workforce training, for urban-rural equity, and for educational access for all Oregonians who want to improve the quality of their lives. And I recognize in House Bill 2450 an opportunity to dedicate funding for K-12 education. I have advocated for dedicated funding for education throughout my legislative career. I recognize in House Bill 2450 funding to provide technical assistance for low-performing schools across the state. This provision addresses one of the mandates of the No Child Left Behind Act. I have long understood, and hopefully we all understand, that the achievement gap as we know it, cannot be bridged without this kind of targeted assistance. The targeted assistance starts with our knowledge that too many of our students, particularly students of color and students from poor families, are languishing in classrooms across this state, and surely we've all read the stories and the headlines. According to the Oregon Progress Board's latest figures, 20% of our youngest students, those of pre-kindergarten age, do not enter school ready to learn. These students are being left behind at the very beginning of their careers. Is it any wonder that only 80% of Oregon third graders are reading at achievement level? We must take the opportunity that lies before us today in House Bill 2450 and design a strategic bipartisan solution that removes barriers to success in school, beginning with preparing children to be ready to learn through programs like Head Start. I recognize in House Bill 2450 a provision for providing Oregon K-12 in the 2007-09 biennium, a provision for funding in that biennium at a level of $5.8 billion higher than other proposals that have circulated in this session, and that offers some funding stability where we have none. And I guess that's the point that I'm here to make, that we don't have funding stability as we sit here on this day, and this is our opportunity to make something happen toward that end in this session. I will support legislation that moves the legislative body in that direction of stability, adequacy, and equity. I will support legislation that at long last offers to our students, our parents, and our educators stability, adequacy, and equity. And I recognize in House Bill 2450 that this is also an opportunity to begin to address statewide tax reform and restructuring. Why do I say that? Because 2450 is a dedication of a portion of our revenue system as we know it. Oregon needs dedicated funding for its schools. I've made the point that I've long stood as an advocate for dedicated funding. We also need dedicated funding for some of our other government services, like our state police. Let me just conclude by saying that we cannot leave this building without completing the jobs we were elected to do, and that one of those responsibilities is providing for a stable and a quality education for all of Oregon's children. And I am here again endorsing House Bill 2450 because I am willing to bridge partisanship and to focus on results for our children. And I thank you for listening.
Thank you. Senator Gourley, do you need to go or can you wait until...
I don't need to go. I'm going to stay until we complete the conversation.
Thank you. Madam Speaker.
I want to thank Senator Gourley for her testimony this morning. She actually, after we hit a bump over in the House, showed up in my office first thing the next morning. She said, Madam Speaker, send me the bill. Send me the bill. She said, whether the Portland provision is in or out, send me the bill. So I want to thank her for her support on this issue. But I thought I'd take a little time this morning and just rehearse for you. Some of you are familiar with the story. Others are a little newer to the process. But just my experience in 20 years in this building and the journey we have been on in regard to education funding and my observations through the 20 years in this legislature. I worked with staff for the majority of that time and had an opportunity to kind of watch the process and how we educate our children in this state. It's been a rough road. And basically with the advent of term limits, education funding has, in my opinion, become a political football. And it's become a bidding war. And the higher the number, the more you care about kids. And it has resulted, I believe, in real damage to not just our schools, but the children that attend those schools, as I've watched what has unfolded probably within the last 4 to 6 years. I think the culmination of the struggle came when our economy took a deep, deep dive in revenues. We found ourselves faced with declining revenue, 5 special sessions, another session, failed ballot measures, and in the meantime, our schools are taking a significant hit. I remember in the 5th special session sitting in the governor's office, then Governor John Kisauber's office, and the relationship in the building had been strained significantly between all the players. And it was a stressful time, both for Democrats, Republicans, lawmakers, trying to grapple with all the needs and the declining revenue. And I sat in that office and as the House Majority Leader at the time. Mark Simmons was the Speaker, Gene Durfler, the Senate President, Peter Courtney was there as the Democrat leader, and I think you were not there. So let me tell you the story of a conversation in that room that day. we sat there and understood that there was going to be a need to ask the voters for more resources to help meet the needs. And the debate in the room that day was whether or not we should put public education under the ask on ballot measure 28 that was going to be a referral. And I remember the exchange of, we shouldn't do that. I know Mark Simmons pleaded to not put schools under that because he was concerned that if the voters did not support that, that schools would have to take a significant cut in the last 6 months of a two-year biennium. As you know, that's not how it ultimately turned out. Schools were put under the cuts, under the taxes, and were ultimately cut significantly. I was a little surprised by some of the conversations in the building because some people thought, well, it's okay. It's okay to let schools suffer a little bit because in the long run they'll get more money. And that was actually a school thought at that time. So we watched last session in particular, ballot measure 28 failed. Schools had to take tough cuts. We were lauded in Doonesbury as not supporting our schools. We, you know, then went into one of the longest sessions in the history of the state because of the continuing downturn in our economy. We're struggling to make pay the bills, and as a result of that, we have ballot measure 30. Again, schools were written a check, but they couldn't cash it. The check bounced. So here we are. I'm sitting in my office a few months ago in March, and I'm watching the 5 o'clock news. I've watched Vicki Phillips' performance as superintendent of Portland Public Schools. I think she's made some bold moves. I think she's come into this state and made some very, very tough, tough choices. And I've spent a little time with her, had a few meetings with her, and have really grown in my respect for her ability to make tough decisions and go out, put herself out there, and she's done a great job. So I was sitting there, and I was watching her on the news, and I was watching her talk about some of the school closures that were going on in Portland. And this is not just about Portland, ladies and gentlemen. It's about schools all over the state and some of the tough choices that are people, school districts, local school boards, and administrators are going through to try to manage the education dollars. And I sat there and I watched it, and I said, it's enough. 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 The next morning I called our legislative revenue officer, Paul Warner, into my office. And I said, Paul, I don't know if I can get this done or not, but if we were going to dedicate funding for K through 12, how would we begin? He suggested three options, two of which would include tax increases. And we know, given what we've just gone through, that voters are not inclined to raise any taxes at this juncture. One was to raise the property tax, which he indicated, you know, was more, the most broad base, but that the voters would have to approve. So we decided that probably wasn't an option. He said you could cobble a tax here and a tax there and dedicate it to K through 12, but probably could not garner enough of those types of smaller taxes in order to support such a large component of the state budget. So then he talked about the income tax and how that is actually one of the most stable components of our tax system because we are an income tax dependent state. And he said it contracts and expands with the economy. And that would probably be the best place to go if you wanted to dedicate a portion of that to K through 12. Thus began the journey of trying to put our arms around what is a responsible number, how can we meet the needs, and we began looking at how we can make the plan work. We have had a House Revenue Committee spent considerable time on this measure. We've had work groups. We've had all folks at the table, Democrats, Republicans, OEA, OSBA, administrators, at the table trying to work this plan. And we ultimately came up, we began with a 50% dedication of the income tax with an 8% operating expense, and then anything that comes in over the 8% would be, a third of that would be dedicated to the stable schools plan, and then the two-thirds would go right into the rainy day fund. After those conversations, the initial conversations were held, the School Board Association made the case that 50% was not enough. So we made some adjustments. We went to 51% and 9% operating expenses. They made the case that PERS was going to be an issue in 07-09, so we adjusted the beginning point to 5.318, which is the governor's Oregon revenue, school revenue group that began the starting point. So we made some adjustments in order to meet some of the concerns in regard to this plan. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think the most important thing this plan will provide is some certainty, some predictability. It allows schools, districts to be able to plan out 6, 8, 10 years. If they know they get a certain percentage, they can lay out long-term thinking. Where today they look at themselves every 2 years and they're uncertain about how much money they're going to have and how are they going to make good decisions, because it's such a biennium to biennium decision making process. So I hope I'm going to ask Paul Warner if that's okay with Senator Brown, maybe have him come up and go over the components of the plan and explain all the puts and takes and where things are at. But I think this is a plan that will allow schools to focus maybe on policy for a change rather than how much money we're going to have, and allow them to be stable. The rainy day component of this plan grows very quickly. And so when we have a downturn, which is inevitable because of our taxing system, there'll be a healthy reserve there in place to keep schools stable so that we can tap into. Paul ran several different models. He ran some including the downturn, showed a decline in the revenue, and if we had a significant downturn, how would the plan fare? And I think he was able to prove that it would provide a good rainy day fund to tap into. It would take a 3/5 vote in order to access that. We felt like that was a responsible level. We don't want somebody just tapping into that because life's a little difficult. We want to make sure that money is there for its intended purpose. When the money goes away, there's a good reserve there for them, members to come together and say, yeah, we want to do this. We want to help schools. And this rainy day fund is dedicated strictly to K-12. So that's its intended purpose, and that was the only thing it could be used for. I hope this committee will give this plan an opportunity to be fully vetted and worked. I would welcome your input, and I'm happy to work with you to make adjustments, make it better, and appreciate, Senator Brown, your time this morning in giving this bill a hearing. If that will take questions.
Thank you. I'd like to hold off on Mr. Warner's testimony until later this afternoon. We have a number of citizens here to testify. Questions for the panel?
Madam Chair, I do have one additional piece of information I would like to share with your indulging that. Being a legislator who represents Multnomah County in Portland, I do want to say that the situation in Portland is dire. I received an email from a constituent, Meg Curry, that paints a picture of what is happening with our teachers, and I want to put this on the record. The layoff slips went out in early April. The immediate consequence of this was that a number of quality teachers who were laid off based on their lack of seniority went to look for new jobs. So even as we become able to rehire folks due to retirements, leaves of absence, et cetera, these energetic young teachers are choosing not to come back to Portland Public Schools. Not only have they likely found other positions by now, but they also are not eager to come back when our financial picture shows no real signs of improvement, and their odds of encountering this situation again next year are fairly good. This includes teachers in whom Portland Public Schools has made a significant investment, including the folks from the Portland Teacher Program, and this is a program of minority teachers. These are young teachers who made a commitment to stay with Portland Public Schools for a set number of years, but are now unable to find positions within Portland Public Schools, and so they've had to be released from their commitment. And this also impacts the level of diversity among our teachers, something we've been struggling to achieve for two decades, Madam Chair. Our recent commitment, continuing with the message in the email, our recent commitment to this means that the most significant levels of diversity have been in recently hired teachers, which places them low on the seniority level. And we're going to lose that, Madam Chair. We're going to lose that investment, and that means that our students are going to lose. And I understand that the Portland piece is gone, but for those who are not willing to support the measure when it included the Portland piece, please understand what that failure to support the measure at that time means for our schools.
If I could, Madam Chair, just as an addendum, we tried to put that Portland piece in. I had 30 Republicans who felt like the Portland piece was a fair exchange for stability in their local communities. And I had 30 members willing to run up the hill, and unfortunately I could not get one Democrat. So I had to take that piece out in order to get the plan on through the House. And it was a tough sell. So with that...
Thank you, Madam Speaker. A couple questions for both of you. My understanding is that business leaders have been telling me that education is extremely important, and I, in fact, over the session, have talked to a number of business who are willing to support an increase in the corporate income tax. Under this proposal, none of the corporate income tax goes to schools. Don't either one of you think that business should be contributing to education, K-12 education in the state?
Actually, Senator Brown, we talked with Paul Warner about that component. He said as a dedication, the personal income tax is the most stable. That does not preclude businesses from putting their resources in. He actually said that the business income tax is the most unstable source. And if you want to count on that for a certain amount of money, it expands, and it's too, as he said, too unpredictable. We talked about that. What if we took a portion? He said it's, you know, when it tanks, when businesses tank, the dollars are gone. If you look at the 80% that capital gains was off after the .com and when we crashed. So it wasn't a conscious decision to leave them out. What Mr. Warner indicated is it's just not a stable source, and you can maybe ask him about that when he comes before the committee.
Madam Chair, I would respond in this way. Absolutely, businesses, corporations should be a part of supporting education in the state. Absolutely. I also believe that we should have a sales tax dedicated to education, pre-K through higher education. But that's not the proposal before us. But we are still here. And as long as we are here, I'm going to put my energies into, as I believe we all want to, put our energies into making something happen around stability for schools in this session before we leave. I'm not willing to leave here without that fight, without being a part of that fight and being a part of that struggle to make something happen.
Thank you. Sam Ringo, just one other question. I think it's fair to say this session that we in the Senate have argued that you all in the House weren't giving schools enough money, and you in the House argued that we weren't giving senior services enough money. I totally agree with you that senior services are extremely important. So I guess my question for you is this. Why not make everything a fixed percentage? For example, senior services. Why not do that?
K-12 is the largest component mm-hmm. of the budget. That takes up Once, in my opinion, once that number is established, we can then turn our attention to the other components of the budget. And everything keys off of the K through 12 number. Everything. And that's been some of the struggle we've had. In order to identify how much money we spend here, it affects all the other programs. I think this proposal not only would stabilize K through 12, but I think it would bring some stability into the other programs, because once K through 12 is established, we can go out and turn our attention to the other programs. We can't divide it all up by percentages, but because K through 12, in my opinion, is the largest piece of the budget, if we can stabilize that and have some predictability in the numbers, we can then turn our attention. It makes it easier to balance the rest of the budget off of that number.
Okay. Got Senator Devlin and Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Speaker, good to see you this morning.
Good morning, Senator.
Richard, are you awake?
Yes.
I'm afraid of.
The School Revenue Forecast Committee was set up by executive order, and it's charged basically simply with trying to determine from sort of a macro level what it would take to continue current school programs in a coming biennium. It in no way addresses the issue of adequacy. It in no way addresses the issues of what cuts have occurred over time in school programs. It simply basically tries to determine what you did last biennium, what will it cost you to do next biennium. When you were trying to arrive at and I know you've adjusted it somewhat, you're now at 51% of individual income taxes, and you're at a 4.5% per annum annual increase rate. What sort of analysis was done on both of those in terms of the issues of adequacy? And I'm not talking so much just about people coming in or OSBA coming in and saying this is adequate or inadequate. I'm talking about actual analysis on adequacy, particularly in relationship to some of the cuts that have occurred and what people might think is an appropriate level for school funding and appropriate level of services provided at the school level.
Some folks use a QEM. They said if you plug in all the assumptions in the QEM, that's adequacy. The problem with adequacy and that debate about adequacy, it depends on who you ask. That's the problem with the discussion on adequacy. Could we? I think we need to draw the parameters a little better, Senator. But it's been my experience, and QEM is held up as the ultimate. You know, if we had all the money in the world, this would be, I think it's $7 billion or $6 billion this session. Frankly, I chaired the Education Subcommittee in '99 that implemented the QEM. And that was, as it was proposed to us, it was a model. In fact, in the House, we've actually used that model to reach our numbers on K through 12. Susan Morgan used it very effectively last session. If you go with the assumptions and you plug in the assumptions, you get your number. So adequacy, in all the time I've been here, and if you go back and read newspapers 100 years ago, adequacy is in the eye of the beholder, and that's been some of the struggle. In this conversation, because nobody has ever really truly been able to define what adequate is. What school districts, in my opinion, have asked for is some predictability, a stabilization, and they can deal with, they know how much money is going to be theirs, and they can do some long-term planning. That is just as important, if not more important. Do they always want more dollars? Absolutely. And part of this plan, I think, will provide a significant boost in K-12 revenue.
Follow up to that.
Senator Devlin.
Madam Speaker, the 4.5% per annum, given the fact that we all know that PERS is now projecting a substantial increase, even with the reforms, for the next biennium, and we all know that if we're lucky, health insurance costs will only increase by 8 or 12% per year. How did you settle on the 4.5%?
The 5318, with the beginning point, the higher beginning point, we began there because of the PERS question, and that was a conversation we had with some of the COSA and OSBA felt like if we could start at a higher level, rather than 5.2 or 5.75 or wherever we end up this session, if we could assume a higher beginning point, that that would go a long way in helping with some of the PERS. And frankly, the PERS issue is supposed to settle out after the 07-09. So it was we started at a higher level to try to address the higher cost in the PERS and the 07-09 filing.
Thank
you. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for coming this morning.
Good morning, sir.
You know, it is hard to pin down what adequacy is. But I know what it is with respect to my family, looking at my kids are going to start first grade in kindergarten next year in Beaverton. And my kindergartner will have 28 kids, probably, and in a half-day class. And I don't need any studies or analysis to know that he's going to be cheated. 28 kids in a kindergarten is ridiculous. I don't need No Child Left Behind. I don't need standardized testing. That's not adequate. It's just not adequate. And from my perspective, stability is good, but if it builds in inadequacy, I'm not interested. I'm just not interested in stability unless there is adequacy. And that's what I want to see in this is adequacy. Senator Brown mentioned, what about the corporate tax revenues? It's true. They fluctuate tremendously. Mm-hmm. They're very unstable. But that doesn't mean we have to leave them off the table.
Senator, I would not object if you wanted to put some corporate dollars into this fund. You're not going to get a fight from the Speaker of the House on that.
Well, all I'm saying is I want to ensure adequacy. I think stability is easily achieved if we're willing to accept inadequacy. We can easily pick a low bar and say, there, we've got stable funding. That's not the goal for my kids, and I don't think it's the goal for the kids in our state.
Senator, do you believe that we could come into the session next session and without even one breath give K-12 5.8 next session?
I have no idea what the forecasts are going to be next session. I don't know.
I think
I have no idea.
That walking into the building, if the stamp plan is implemented, we're at close to 5.8 next session.
Well, I just want to say that stability is no doubt important. I mean, it's important for businesses, it's important for people, families, it's important for schools. But we can't pretend that stability is the goal. We also have to look at adequacy, and that's my concern. So I appreciate the objective. I guess my other comment, Madam Chair, is that it's true that K-12 budget becomes a political fight. There's no doubt about that. We have a lot of political fights in this building, and I don't see how it's practical to insulate us from those political fights. And as Senator Brown mentioned, the Human Services budget, that's a political fight. I mean, we all use these budgets and a million issues to beat one party against the other party, and it's too bad. It's too bad that we don't rise above this. But I don't see that the reason to push this is to prevent difficult political battles. I'd rather make sure we have adequacy funding in schools.
I think my heart was more about the kids, Senator.
That's good.
So they're
okay.
Not put on buses and brought down here. And
right.
If they go into Senator Ringel's office and say, if we don't get X amount of dollars, then I don't get to go to school next year.
Yep.
To me, that's what this is about.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sarah Atkinson.
Thank you. Just a comment. Thank you both for coming. I enjoyed both of your testimony. I think you both should be applauded for taking on what I consider to be what is our responsibility to leave the legislature better than we found it, which is this issue. And I think you both should be applauded for your bravery for bringing on what I believe is the most dishonest debate in Salem, which is funding of K-12. I think this proposal and many of the analytics that you're using are very similar to where I'm coming from on the 81-day bill that we fought on the floor, but it locked up partisan with a few exceptions. And I think what you're doing is fantastic. I think that as long as you leave it a political fight, nothing is ever going to get fixed in this state.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you can't be a Republican and be for K-12 because that's not how the game is played, I think that's pathetic. I applaud what you're doing. I think it's part of anything we can do to fix the legislature, which is what our charge is. If it's stability at 51% or the timing of when those budgets are, certainty for school districts, I think it's great. So I really applaud both of your bravery, and Madam Speaker, I'm glad to have you on the Senate side.
Thank you, sir.
Madam Chair, if I could respond
sure.
to Senator Atkinson, thank you very much for those words and for the affirmation in the words. And I want to just be on record and be very, very clear that I am not sitting here as an advocate for inadequate school funding. That is not what this proposal is about. I think the speaker has made it very clear that the committee has an opportunity to do some work on the measure, to enhance it, improve it. Again, this is about stability, and it is about certainty for our school districts who are currently unsure of what this legislative assembly is going to do. And again, this is not about putting into cement inadequate funding for schools. Let's be very clear about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for holding the hearing. I'd like to join my colleagues in appreciating the chair. You've been remarkably accessible to all members in the Rules Committee, and I think that is an example for future rules chairs. The proposal that is before us today, it has become a lightning rod, and it sharply defines the political battles in the building. And it is a hard question. It is a difficult debate. And it's one where people's motives are easily characterized by the opposition. And so that's why I'm gratified by seeing Senator Gordley's partnership with the speaker on the issue, because that makes people think hard about whether or not this proposal is one that we can look at objectively across party lines, understand that there's no alternative really that we're debating. You know, I appreciate Senator Ringo's concern for the number of students in those classrooms. It's a tough thing to walk into a class and see a teacher and a teacher aide with almost 30 kindergartners. It's my
no aid, Senator Farrioli.
No aid. Yes. Well, that's my definition of purgatory.
Especially given it's Senator Ringo's son.
Yeah.
So
tough room. It's a tribute to the dedication of teachers, unquestionably. And other than just to say, you know, maybe we could push the numbers around a little more, there's really no better alternative on the table. Voters in their wisdom have sliced and diced the lottery dollars, which were to be dedicated to education funding. We now have economic development, parks and recreation, salmon restoration, and a few other items have been piled onto that thing. So even our early attempts to try to find a mechanism that's stable and accessible and available for school funding, you know, met with some political issues that have sidetracked it. I don't see the competing proposal. Perhaps we'll hear.
Actually, Senator Farrioli, the Senate has sent out about 8 measures to reform the education system. I'm happy to get those bill numbers for you, but they're all sitting in the House, including a rainy day fund and reformation of the ESD system and reformation of how we pay our administrators. So to say that there's no competing proposals is inaccurate, Senator Farrioli.
I appreciate you bringing that up, because we actually had a minority report running to the floor that would have offered perhaps a similar program to the speaker's, although it was 53% and the Portland money was in it. But it was pulled back off the floor. So senators have not had an opportunity to vote on this proposal.
And that's
or a proposal
correct.
Like it. I hope, Madam Chair, that after this hearing, we'll see this bill move to the floor so the Senate can vote it up or down.
Just to clarify for the record, the reason the minority that you chose to pull the minority report back is because I offered you a public hearing on this bill, in case you'd forgotten. That you were given a choice to either have the minority report be heard on the Senate floor or this bill have a public hearing, and I think you chose wisely, Senator Farrioli.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we still have an opportunity, and I hope that opportunity is to give senators a chance to vote on this proposal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Shields.
Senator Shields, that was me last time I checked. I'm very aware that in a couple minutes I have to go do an invocation because somebody canceled in the Senate chamber, and so I get to go pray over that body. And I keep reflecting on what invocation means. It means to invoke, you know, God's wisdom. And if ever we need it in this context. I just kind of like to remind us all of that. I know we come from various backgrounds and various faiths and non-faith and so on, but we're going to need a whole lot of wisdom. I see the merit, I see the courage of both sides in the debate, and I see us very quickly getting to the point where we can spar with one another rather than try and work on a solution. I agree with our chair that there are several pieces of an education package that have passed the Senate floor. So we've got a tough road ahead to sort it out and to figure out what's right. And I do appreciate the hearing this morning and what's been shared this morning. And I appreciate you, Madam Chair, having this hearing. I want to thank you for the time.
Anything further? Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. I'd like to get up Tom Olson, Zoe Walmer, and Kathy Sampson. You guys can move the floor. That's fine. These are the folks that I have that I want to get on. We just need to clear the call for the rest of the testimony. That's what I thought. I'd like to come back at 1 to hear the rest of the testimony, but I'm waiting to see if we can do that. Can you come back at 1 to hear the rest of the testimony?
Absolutely.
Good morning. Everyone's rushing off to floor session. We'd like to get your testimony on. I know you folks have, most of the other folks, I think, can come back at a later time. So, you're welcome. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Tom Olson, and Zoe and Kathy and I are all members of Stand for Children. I'm a grandparent who lives in Canby. I've recently retired also. I started as a high school teacher and became a school administrator, but the past 30 years, my role has been as a strategic planning specialist, advising and training thousands of people in school districts in 20 U.S. states and Pacific territories. Things in education are dramatically different today than they were 30 years ago. There are now public policies, as Senator Gordley reminded us, requiring that we actually guarantee proficiency for each and every student. This is a quantum leap from our historic precedent of focusing policy on expanding access to education. The depth of this new challenge is equivalent to the airplane industry's making the shift from propeller-driven to jet-propelled airplanes. And they certainly didn't accomplish that by artificially capping their resource commitments. Current methods of schooling were designed for a different era. They must now be transformed, again, as Senator Gordley reminded us, to meet the higher demands of the 21st century. For example, Oregon's school year this year falls 73 days short of what students in Japan experience. The demands of global competition require dramatically new and different capacity in school districts to meet these challenges. Today we need major investments, a term I haven't heard yet in the conversation. We need major investments in our public education system. Unfortunately, as the new policy demands for proficiency for all, in the face of growingly diverse populations with greater learning challenges, as these policy demands have taken shape, Oregon, at the same time, disinvested in public education. For example, in just the past 5 years, my local district, Canby, has had to cut $5 million out of its budget. When adjusted for inflation, Oregon now spends $611 less per student than in 1992. Oregon's rank among U.S. states in our per pupil investment has fallen from 16th among the states in 1989-90 to 31st in 2002-2003. Soon we might match Mississippi. Oregon's elementary class sizes are second largest in the country. And more recently, we see the dropout rate increasing statewide. Does this represent a commitment to investment? Certainly it does not. House Bill 2450 totally ignores the issue of adequacy in funding. It locks into future funding Oregon's sad history of disinvestment over the past decade. The primary objective of the measure is setting restrictive spending caps rather than investment. Some have suggested we can fix House Bill 2450's flaws simply by, say, increasing the percentage from 51% to 53%. But this ignores other fundamental flaws. It relies solely on private income tax, as Senator Brown reminded us. It lets Oregon's corporations totally off the hook for any responsibility for K-12 education. Is this the ultimate manifestation of Oregon's recent history of creating even more loopholes for corporations? Don't corporations bear some responsibility for investment in the quality of their future workers? Additionally, the personal income tax is highly volatile, and the plan's exclusive reliance on it destroys the promise of predictability and stability in school funding. Let's step back, and I echo the sentiment of on a bipartisan basis, and shift the state policy discussion from spending caps in public education to the kinds of investment necessary if Oregon is to truly thrive in the future. A good first step is to return to the data presented by the Oregon's quality education model, and for the state to begin to take seriously the notion of adequate investments necessary to transform our schools. House Bill 2450 is a roadblock to that rational dialogue and policy making. It's bad public policy, and it should be defeated. Thank you.
Thank you. Who needs to go? I know you're both being too polite. Go.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today on behalf of High Quality Education for Oregon's 550,000 school children. My name is Kathy Sansoni, and I taught for 31 years in Oregon public schools, and currently I instruct future teachers at both OSU and George Fox University. And Senator Ringo, when I retired, I had an average of 35 students in each of my six classes at the high school level. I think that's far from adequate. You probably remember that several months ago, many of you joined Stand for Children and the Oregon PTA and over 3,000 Oregonians on the steps of the Capitol in support of no further cuts for our public schools. Speaker Minnis has stated repeatedly that the best reason to vote for this plan is to keep us from coming back to Salem. We can promise that the approval of this plan will only cause more parents and students to be here advocating for the adequate funding that this bill lacks, as we know that Oregonians consistently rate education as a top priority. We all know that there's got to be a better way to fund our schools and to improve efficient, accountable management of the public's investment in K-12. But a last-minute adoption of a spending cap for our schools is certainly not it. Stand for Children's 3,000 members in Oregon are committed to working with the legislators throughout the interim on proposals advanced by the Chalkboard Project and others to come back to the next session with increased support for an investment in public education that makes our schools among the best in the nation. As a member of Stand for Children, I'm urging you today to stand behind the $5.325 billion budget for K-12 that you've already passed, along with the cost efficiency, accountability, and stability bills you've approved. I urge you to stand for quality education for our students rather than settling for a package that continues to weaken our system. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Walmer.
I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to address you today, at least Senator Brown and Senator Ringo. My name is Zoe Walmer, and I'm a sophomore at Lake Ridge High School in Lake Oswego, and I'm the Director of Outreach for the Youth Caucus, which is a nonpartisan student activist group which engages young people in the political process and educates them about their democracy. Year after year, adults in the community watch our budget being cut, and they see the numbers go down, and they say, what a shame. But year after year, students in the community see, not the numbers, but the quality of our schools going down. That's what we notice. I'm not worried about the numbers that are printed in the paper because the numbers don't have much meaning for me. I'm worried about losing days, teachers, and classes. when we talk about how schools are losing money. That's really not the issue. It's what those dollars represent. They represent opportunities. Opportunities that we no longer have because of slashes to our funding. I've had two older brothers go through Lakeridge in past years, and collectively, we've seen a loss of 19 teachers and 40 classes and several school days. We've lost musical theater, wood, metal, and auto shop, home economics, Latin, Russian, building instruction, drafting, discrete math, philosophy and ethics, stereo physics, several business and money management classes, and screenwriting. We pay over $200 to play a sport or be in elementary band or orchestra programs, but we're lucky to have them at all these days. I've played viola since the fourth grade, and it wasn't always easy to find the funds to pay for it. Not everyone in Lake Oswego has deep pockets. Today is the day after Independence Day, and despite some bumps in the road, I'm proud to be an American, and especially an Oregonian. It's a fantastic state and a fantastic nation where, hopefully, everyone has the opportunity to learn and to better themselves and to take part in the opportunity that Oregon represents. No place in our country holds more opportunity than our schools. We are the leaders of tomorrow. We are the teachers, we are the workforce, we are the consumers, and we are the legislators. The investment made in us and in our education is the wealth that Oregon possesses tomorrow. I want to be a legislator in Oregon someday because I love this state and believe that it has an amazing potential. I just hope that today's legislators don't close the door on that opportunity. We have a chance to have world-class education and serve as a model for the nation and the world of what a place can be like when an investment is made in students. This bill has the right idea. We need steady, reliable investment in our schools so that we can rely on having informed citizens in the future. The problem is that this bill doesn't provide that. It gives us a ceiling when what we need is a floor. It gives us locks when we need our keys to the doors of opportunity and achievement. The income tax is incredibly volatile and shifts wildly with the economy. It is among the most unreliable sources of funding available. Why would this be chosen as the main source of funding for one of the best returns on investment? This plan also puts no responsibility on corporations, who are among those who benefit most from an educated workforce. The philosophy of steady funding so that we don't have to come back here session after session begging and scratching for pennies and nickels is very good, but the methods and details of House Bill 2450B lock us out of steady funding, not into it. The only thing that this bill secures is failure. Our schools hold people who, while they may not know it yet, are the decision makers of tomorrow. We will do great things if given the chance. Dollars and cents aren't just dollars and cents. They're days, teachers, and opportunities for greatness. We will be great if you give us keys instead of locks. I know the session is wrapping up soon and the decision needs to be reached, but this plan is giving up, and you should never give up on an opportunity. Please oppose House Bill 2450. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walmer. I think you're well on your way. Senator Ringo, any questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much. I know there are a number of folks wishing to testify. We'd like to be in recess till 1. I know not everybody can come back, but I know a number of you can since you're here all the time. So we'll be in recess till 1. Thank you all very much. Good afternoon, everyone. We're back in Senate Rules. It is July 5th. We're hearing House Bill 2450. Representative Merkley, did you wish to come forward? Okay.
Thank
you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come in and testify on 2450. Given the lateness of session, I'll try to be brief. My main concern about this bill is that it's structured as a spending cap for education. And this has been an issue of some conversation. I've taken the liberty of asking staff to pass out to you a memo from Legislative Council addressed to me regarding 2450. You should have it before you with some luck.
Yes, we do.
The point of this was that in reading and analyzing the legislation, it appeared that it was set up as a spending cap of either 9% growth or 51% of personal income tax, whichever is lower, within some details about where the money goes. The 9% is rules, because it is lower, then the difference between it and the 51% goes into a fund, and you've probably looked at those details. And those funds become available to come back at certain points with a supermajority. But the bottom line is that with some detailed caveats. Essentially, this is a spending cap at either 9% growth or 51%. It is the concern of this legislator and many on the House side that passing a spending cap sends the wrong message to the parents, to the children, certainly to the corporate world in Oregon, because it says that we are not going to go any higher than this. Now, some have said, well, it's not really a spending cap because you could repeal it. And that's like saying a tax increase isn't a tax increase because you can repeal it. Or any other piece of legislation isn't what it actually says because you can repeal it. In this case, you can repeal it in one of three ways. You can repeal it in its entirety, you can amend it, or you can pass subsequent legislation that, because it's near in time, overrules this legislation. So you can remove it in one of three ways. But unless you do that, then this is, in fact, what it says as a spending cap. So our schools have experienced innumerable cuts that have affected the quality that they provide to our children, from outdoor school to extracurricular activities, fees, basic programs, foreign languages, so on and so forth. You're all very familiar with that, so I won't belabor it. But what our schools really need is a spending floor that would say we are serious about providing a quality education in this state, and that we are going to make sure that our schools don't go off the cliff, that they will not collapse because revenue collapse, and that they can still aspire towards excellence. And so I hope that the committee will take a close look at this, and also a close look at the legislation that has been introduced by some of your Senate colleagues, the number of which is 1091, Senate Bill 1091, which seems to me like a very sensible approach to providing just such a floor tied to adequacy. Thank you for the committee's time.
Thank you, Representative Merkley. Questions for Representative Merkley? Representative Merkley, before you go, the Speaker expressed concern after meeting with members of the Portland delegation that folks would not support the gap proposal that was in her stability fund. I was just curious whether you yourself had any conversations with the Portland School Board about the gap bond issue.
I have had some conversations, thank you, Senator Brown, Madam Chair, with the couple members of the Portland School Board. And quite frankly, the sense of the House Portland delegation, there are 14 members who have some piece of the Portland Public Schools, is that these two bills were apples and oranges, that combining them into a single vehicle on the House side made little sense, took away from the merits of the discussion on both pieces. And it's certainly my hope that important issues facing school districts across the state can be addressed, and providing enhanced forms of local option to various school districts would make sense. I hope we can find a way to do that with a view to the children throughout the state.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Shields.
I just want to push that a little bit more, Representative, and that is, did the 14 members of the caucus ever have a chance to sit down with the school board or superintendent, kind of in a mass, and have a time of sharing and getting to feel where one another's pain?
The members did invite the superintendent. She was unable to come, but we did meet with one member of the school board and an individual representing the school board. Of the 14, I think approximately 8 were able to attend. All 14 members sent a letter to the Portland Public Schools Board and to the superintendent expressing our concerns about the very bill you have in front of you. And but that really was about this bill, not about the bonding gap. But it was explaining why something important to our particular district was not something that we would change our support for an underlying bill, which needed to be considered on its own merits.
Thank you. And Representative Merkley, when did those conversations with the Portland School Board member occur?
Approximately 2 weeks ago, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us today. John Marshall, Kent Hunsicker.
And Anthony, is it Lanny?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon Sports Association, appearing before you this afternoon in support of the concept contained in House Bill 2450. School board members over the last several years have been asking themselves a consistent question. How can we possibly prepare our students for a successful future when we can only consider our school's financial future in a series of 1 or 2 year increments? The answer, in short, is we can't. Without stability and predictability in K-12 funding, we're forced to deal with financial uncertainty from year to year. Over the last 4 years, we've made modest program improvements in the first year, only to reduce or eliminate them in the next. To provide some semblance of financial stability on our own, we hold a small amount of our total funds in reserve, only to be chastised by our critics for rat-holing dollars that should be spent on classroom needs.
Thank you.
We sit by every 2 years and wait for the legislature to make its appropriation to K-12 schools that too often occurs after we're forced by law to adopt our own local budgets. We believe that House Bill 2450 provides a structure for K-12 funding stability and predictability that's worthy of consideration and possibly even support. There's been a great deal of discussion about the issue of adequacy. And in my 2 decades of hanging around here, that has been a topic of debate every 2 years, and my fear is it will continue to be a topic of debate. And I think the question is, if we're looking for, as we are, K-12 funding adequacy, stability, and equity, is it possible in this environment to attain all of those features in one fell swoop? And I'm afraid that we've reached the opinion that that's not possible in this current environment. So the question is, can we peel off a piece of that and focus on it and achieve what we believe is a floor for school funding that will create the opportunity for a more rational debate of where we ought to be in terms of adequacy? And we define adequacy as the investment in our public education system matching the expectations we have for it. And I don't think any of us would argue that we're there, that the investment we're making matches the expectations for student achievement coming out the other end. So let's look at House Bill 2450 without dealing with numbers and try to determine whether or not there's a structure that's worthy of our continued work. The first is a dedicated amount of existing revenue for K-12 schools. And we have argued about new dedicated revenue sources, making the pie bigger, et cetera. Short of that, however, is it possible to take existing revenue and dedicate some amount to it for K-12 schools so that from year to year we'll have at least some knowledge of what the funding floor is going to be? Given that dedication of an existing amount of revenue, is it possible to set some level of biennial growth in the state school fund that's not only stable and predictable, but also affordable given other budget considerations, as well as sustainable over time? House Bill 2450 contains a starting point that recognizes where K-12 funding should be in 05-07 if we were operating under more favorable financial circumstances, and that's the number that was produced by the School Revenue Forecast Committee. Dollars in excess of providing for that sustainable level of growth in the state school fund can enhance deposits into the Education Stability Fund to better support K-12 funding during the next economic downturn, which we know will occur. The question is when and how deep will it be? And to eventually help school districts with their capital construction and improvement needs, which in some areas of the state are severe. It creates a fund to assist those school districts that are struggling to move their students towards our academic achievement standards. And we believe that given the requirements of No Child Left Behind, as well as schools meeting our own student achievement standards, that a fund to assist, targeted assistance to those schools with what we're going to term chronically low-performing schools, is of value. The bill contains a regular legislative review of the proposal's financial components to recognize changes in state and federal law. So there is an opportunity to revisit whatever percentages and numbers the body ultimately decides on. And finally, two components of House Bill 2450 that we've worked on from the beginning of the legislative session that we believe are important. One is the provisions of the bill make two components of the current state school fund distribution formula permanent. One is the small school district supplement fund that provides additional dollars out of the state school fund to help small school districts operate their small high schools. And finally, a program that helps school districts with the excess costs of those low-incidence, high-cost, or serving those low-incidence, high-cost students with disabilities. And we think those are two components that are worthy of continuing and make a permanent part. The bill before you represents a serious discussion about a fundamental K-12 funding issue. And I would again suggest that while the whole topic of adequacy, equity, and stability should not be removed from the legislature's agenda, I think the question is, can we achieve it all at once in the near term or perhaps even the long term? And short of that, is it possible to peel off a very fundamental issue and have a responsible and reasonable discussion surrounding it? So we think House Bill 2450 contains a structure that's sound, and we look forward to working with you, just as we did over on the House side, to try to continue to refine the measure and hopefully make it even better. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next. Would like to go next.
I'll go. Good afternoon. My name is Kent Hunsaker. I'm the Executive Director for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's great to be here today. I think the debate that we're about to have regarding this bill is extremely important. One of the things that in my short period of time, in my prior life I was a superintendent, heard about a lot of the things that were going on in the legislature, but I've seen the same thing happen from year to year to year, and that is, how much is education going to get, some type of a bidding war, and my recent analysis I'm going to go over this morning is that education is losing that bidding war and that the kids in Oregon are suffering really badly. As I look back to the 01-03 biennium, for example, schools were by the legislature funded at $5.2 billion in that biennium.
I'm sorry, what year was that?
01-03. Well, they were originally funded at $5.2
mm-hmm.
billion.
That's correct.
And then as the legislative sessions, the special sessions occurred, that fell to 4.7. In the 03-05 biennium, again, the legislature approved $5.2 billion. And with the failure of Measure 30, that became 4.9. 5.2 is now the magic number almost. I've heard 5.22, 5.27, 5.3, but somewhere around there, 4 years later, is now still the magic number for schools. During that period of time, however, PERS rates have gone from 11 to 17. Health insurance has increased by double digits each of the 4 years. And we've had enrollment growth with students. We've had high energy costs. And we have seen across the state what is happening to our schools as we've lost programs. We've lost good people in our system. We've contracted out services. And as the student testified this morning, they're the ones that really, really feel it. As we look at this plan, we have felt from the beginning that this plan provides a framework to have a different discussion about the way you fund education. When the bill originally was put out, it had 50%, 8% as the growth on the current funding level, whatever it may be. Since then, with some suggestions for change, that's changed to 51% and 9%, and the growth starting on 5.318.
The Senate Republicans' plan had 53% in it. They'd offer you even a better deal.
Exactly. And but I'm here to tell you that as we deal with that, the plan attempts to deal with predictability, stability, and adequacy. It does a pretty good job with the first two, but it doesn't do the job as you talk about adequacy. And I would like to direct you to the sheets that I handed out. There's five sheets in the paper. And the first one was one that I put together, and it looks at education from 03-05 forward as a percentage of general fund revenue.
Did you look backwards at all? Because my recollection from the numbers is that the percentage for the K through 12 numbers over the last several sessions hasn't varied that much, that there's only been about a 1% to 3% difference in the amount that we've allocated.
That's in the third sheet. When I get to that, okay. we'll go backwards. The only reason I did this exercise is was to look at it in a different way. The speaker's bill looks at this as a percentage of personal income tax. So if you only look at it that way, I thought it'd be nice to also have some other indicators. So the first set of numbers compares, and by the way, this bill before at one time was called 3460, and I had that number up here, so sorry about the change. 3460 is now 2450B. And if you look at in 03-05, our education share of the general fund was 47%, 47.3. In 05-07, depending on what the number is, it's going to go down. And under the speaker's plan, you can see how that number also goes down in the following years. The next chart looks at it as a percentage of personal income tax. And in 03-05, education share of the personal income tax was 54.7%. In 05-07, it could be as low as 51.6%. And in the following years, under the speaker's plan, at 51, it drops. And you'll note that there's obviously money going into a stability fund there that's not counted in the numbers because 51% is allocated each year. It's just not allocated to operating money. And then the next page is a page that was prepared by Jim Scherzinger. And he did this because we funded schools on basically in the past on lottery and general fund revenue. So I've squared the last two boxes, or they're the boxes below that they're appropriate to the other numbers I was looking at, which says in 03-05, our percentage of the general fund, 44.7. At 4220, that drops to 42.2% of general fund plus lottery revenue. And that's what I'm saying is that schools are losing the bidding war. No matter how you look at it, there is less of the general fund plus lottery, personal income tax, whatever comparator you want to use that's going to public education. The third sheet is the historical sheet, and it only compares it to personal income tax. And what that shows you is that over the last five bienniums, education's share of the personal income tax has been, as average, 55.4%. And I provide that to you only for the perspective of looking at adequacy in terms of the speaker's plan, which is now personal income tax at 51%. And in 03-05, you'll notice again that it was around 55. We have looked at the numbers and would propose a couple of alternatives for you as you seek to look forward and deal with the issues of adequacy. They adjust the starting point, and they adjust the growth rate. The first one is page 4, and it allocates 54% of the personal income tax to K-12. You'll notice that in 07-09, that would be $6.131 billion. And that there is no money that goes into the stability fund or the improvement fund. And the reason for that is as we know, as we look at 07-09, we know what kind of increases are already out there. They're already talking about PERS going from the current 17% rates to close to 25%. We know we're going to have enrollment growth. We know we're going to have health insurance and salary increases and higher energy costs. So that proposal allows for 54% to go to all to operating costs in 07-09. And from then on, 10% growth on that base. And page 5 is the same thing, only at 55%. What I would encourage you to do as a group is to think about this thing as a framework. And if you put the right numbers into the framework, does it work? Now, this doesn't provide the quality ed model. And what I have come to realize is that under the current tax structure, we can't look at the quality ed model as a reason. You know, we're only $2 billion short of funding the quality ed model. So there isn't money to do that. But if we can provide a bridge until there is a redoing of the tax structure with something like this with the right numbers, then it could assure kids of a good education in this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lanny.
Chair Senator Brown, Vice Chair Senator Ferrioli, and Senator Shields. With your indulgence, I'll read from my report for the simple reason that I tend to ramble, and this way I'll be done quickly. I am in favor of House Bill 2450 for a number of reasons that affect school budgets and programming, and I support it for the stability it would bring to school funding. The funding is stabilized at 51% of the income tax revenues collected by the state. In addition, the bill provides for future growth at 9% per annum, which over 5 biennia would increase the state school fund by approximately 50%. The Education Stability Fund built into it would be used in years of decreased revenue, and the bill provides a reopener every 4 years to adjust the funding if necessary when the state or federal tax policy is changed. Schools are required to have operational budgets on July 31st of each year. The state funding schools receive has not been determined early enough in past years to be accurately included in the school's funding plans. Many schools include estimates and use low estimates to be sure the school will have enough money in their budgets to fund the entire school year. These low estimates often require that staff would need to be reduced. Since superintendents need to notify staff that their jobs might be in jeopardy before funding is determined, the affected staff seeks other positions. Thus, an unanticipated effect of this technique is the loss of good licensed staff. HB 2450 would provide an earlier and more accurate estimate of school funding for the upcoming school budget year and help stabilize staffing disruption. HB 2450 will provide multi-year funding stability for schools that is currently lacking. This stability will enhance meaningful long-range planning. Curriculum initiatives for improvements such as the federal mandate of No Child Left Behind is by nature a long-range mission. No Child Left Behind is developed over the course of the student school years. It has benchmarks which all students must meet at different points in their education. Such programs cannot be successful on a short-term basis. Those children who fall below the benchmark levels must be remediated. Such an endeavor requires long-range planning. Long-range planning is important in the maintenance of our school's physical atmosphere. A proper maintained maintenance program saves money over time by extending the life of facilities and equipment while keeping our students in a safe physical environment. The education of our students is of primary concern, but students are members of a community, and other community needs compete for revenue. The political process pits school funding against health, mental health, assisted living facilities, law enforcement, other social programs which are necessary for a healthy community. HB 2450 will take education out of this battleground for the benefit of the entire community. Although the initial level of 51% is a minimum, the 9% growth rate built into the bill will secure school funding against inflation. It provides 4.5% per year increase for the foreseeable future. Should more funding be necessary, the law requires a regular review every 4 years when state or federal tax policy is changed. The Education Stability Fund would be available to be used in years of low tax receipts. In this sense, HB 2450 stabilizes school funding against rapid changes in revenue. Superintendents in my county, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler, and Grant, as a body, support this bill. There are some that adamantly believe that more money One especially believes that more money should be available. As an educator, I believe that the advantages of Health Bill 2450 outweigh any disadvantage, and the stability it will provide in the future will be best for our schools. Thank you very much.
Thank you. A couple of questions. Mr. Hunziker, you said in your comments that we're losing the bidding war. And as I look at your numbers on page two, is the share of general revenue to schools, it looks to me that schools are basically holding their own. I mean, since 93-95, we've basically been in the range of 43% to 45%. I do note that the number used is 5.220 billion, giving this year this session's percentage of 42.2. I don't know if that changes if you move use the Senate number, which was 5.325 that we passed off the Senate floor. Does that change that percentage number a little bit?
It does, but when you consider that it's a drop from 44.7 to 42.2 with this, you're still going to go to about 43.5 or something like that. It's going to be better, but we're still losing it no matter what the indicator is and where we get. So we're about $200 million short of maintaining the piece of the pie that we've had in the past, if you use those numbers. So the big change is not in the past. It is from 03-05 to 05-07 and what is proposed.
So if this bill had been in place for the 03-05 biennium, my calculation, 51% of the personal income tax revenues, they were $5.87 billion. The percentage would have been about $329 million less than we actually gave K through 12 schools, i.e., it would have been less $329 million less than 4.9. Does that not give you any concerns about this proposal?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I hope that what I said in my testimony is the 51% is not adequate, and
okay,
that we are strongly recommending the historical average, which is 55, which is if you go back to that, then if you use that average and you take it through, then it would provide the same amount of money that you have there. And it looks at historical averages, and obviously there's a big difference between 51 and 55. But the rationale is that's the history. That's what you provided over the last five bienniums. Why would you not? And so, that's my challenge to you and this in the Senate is take the bill, take the numbers, and fix the numbers. Send it back, see what happens.
So, and I guess the question then I would turn to Mr. Marshall then. We're debating right now about $50 to $100 million about K through 12 funding. Doesn't the debate, should we pass this bill, then really turn on percentage? And instead of having a numbers debate, don't we end up having a percentage debate? Because every chamber essentially can vote to change the percentage. So Mr. Hunziker thinks it's 55%. Senator Farioli thinks it's 53%. My Democrats would probably choose 60%. Isn't that what the debate becomes, is a percentage debate as opposed to an actual numbers debate if we pass this legislation?
Well, Madam Chair, certainly because House Bill 2450 is statutory, then I can envision at some point in the future all kinds of bills that start off notwithstanding. But I think to lay out, for this legislature to lay out a plan for the future that it becomes more of a political incentive, I think, than probably a legal one. And just given where we've been and giving schools the ability to look forward and know that not just from next year or the following, but several years down the road, there's a level of growth on which they can count, I think that's valuable. That's not to say that the debate will not continue. And I believe that should House Bill 2450 become law, then the debate in the next legislative session will be, hopefully it won't be how to adjust the percentages that exist. It will be, okay, this is the floor. Now, what's the difference between the floor that's created in House Bill 2450 and where we ought to be? And I think that's a much better debate to have than the one that we're having now, which has been suggested, is that it becomes a political football and a bidding war.
Thank you. Two last questions. Mr. Hunziker spoke about the rising cost of health insurance and the concern about dollars not getting into the classrooms. Just curious where your, both of your organizations are on two bills that the Senate has passed. One is Senate Bill 639, which is the insurance pooling, and is the governor's proposal to put more money directly into the classrooms. The other proposal is Senate Bill 766, which deals with making sure that certain superintendents and administrators don't get, so we say, golden parachutes when they leave. Just curious where your organizations are.
Record, Madam Chair, as opposing both bills.
Okay. Mr. Hunziker?
We're on record as opposing both bills, and I would be happy to talk about some of the testimony I'd given, for example, in the area of health insurance. Our concern there is that there is no evidence that we will have a better plan at a lower cost. And we have said that we would support something that said, you bid it, you get it. If it's savings, we support it. We support savings that are there. What we know now is that the OSBA rates are lower than the rates of the of PEB, and the assumption is that they're going to be better if you just bring some more bodies in, and we don't believe that's the case unless it can be shown. So bid it, show us that it'll be there, we'd support.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions, Senator Ferriello?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've had some concerns about the quality education model since it was framed, and it has to do with putting a model out there and watching the model drivers and watching the numbers just really ratchet up. And I'm wondering if you'd care to comment on, have you studied the QEM and you know, we've got some folks in the building that want to go restudy and reshoot the QEM and come up with a better model that's more predictive, or at least more connected to the reality of our situation in Oregon.
I.e. less expensive.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the point is it's now at $7 billion, and even if we had a 6% sales tax, you couldn't fund it. So the point I'm getting at is one of the things that Mr. Hunziker or a previous somebody previously testified is about the adequacy and the affordability of the program, and that's got to be a concern for people in this building. It's not just the adequacy. I think all of us want to see as much as we possibly can get into education, but you do run into the question of affordability. And the thing that bothers me about the quality education model is that there's no funding mechanism I can see that we could achieve that would get you to $7 billion in funding for K-12 this or next cycle. So have you formed some opinion about what ought to happen with the QEM? Is that part of the problem, is that we've made expectations that are unreachable?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferriola, I think that, as I described earlier, we have to come up with a definition of adequacy on which we can all agree. And I believe that adequacy has to focus on the difference between the investment we're making and the investment we ought to be making to ensure that all students have an opportunity to meet the standards for the reset for them. In my personal view, I think the quality education model attempts to answer the wrong question. It tries to answer the question, how much will it cost to get 90% of our students to the rigorous academic standards we've set? And I think that the experts behind the quality education model have done the best that they could to come up with an answer to that question. The reality is that I don't know if even if in the best of worlds, the most ideal, we could get 90% of our kids there. I just don't see how that's possible. So I think the quality education model and the commission ought to focus on how much would it cost to assure that all students have an opportunity to reach the standards that we've set. And I believe that answering the second question becomes much more quantifiable. For example, to assure that all elementary kids get to reading and math benchmarks, then what should class sizes be? Should the professional development for the licensed staff look like? And it would seem to me that there has to be a better way of coming up with a definition of what is adequacy. I remember that the conversation, Senator Brown, that you had with Representative Merkley, where you brought in a bunch of school folks and you asked them how much would it take next biennium to sort of make sure that you're on the same plane that you are now. That is, you can maintain your existing programs and services. And the difference was $1 billion plus. So it would seem to me that we've got to get to a point where we can decide on what is adequacy and then try to create some kind of a mechanism to get there over time.
Mr. Hunziker wants to respond.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferriello, just one comment that I think applies. I'm very familiar with the quality ed model. And keep in mind, a key aspect of that model is the number of students that would be in a classroom at all levels. I heard Senator Ringo say this morning that his son or daughter, I forget which it was, is in a kindergarten classroom of 28 kids. My son, who used to live in Sherwood, was going to put his kid into a classroom of 30 students in kindergarten, and he moved to Washington instead. But big factor in the quality ed models, it sets class sizes at each of the grade levels and says that's the way we're going to fund our schools. Very expensive to do that, and that is the thing that raises the cost, and it is the greatest demand that's out there. If you want to talk with anybody that's in the system, will that tell you? I want my kid in a reasonable sized classroom.
Senator Ferriello.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The speaker's plan resets the number in the out years to 5.318. I think that's the number. Or somebody testified to that earlier. What effect does that have on the proposal before us?
I can answer. Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, the speaker's plan says that they're going to do the roll-up on 5.318, just as if you had 5.318 in this biennium, with the assumption that it's not going to get there. But that would be what the roll-up would be. So the effect is that it does raise the number for 0709 to a higher number. That's 5791 is the number that it raises to if the income tax goes the way it does. So it does a higher roll-up, assuming that what passes this legislative session is less than 5318.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Ferrioli. So before you go on, I just want to make this really clear. The bill presumes that we fund schools at 5.318 this biennium. Why was that number picked?
Madam Chair, that number was picked because it was the number given by the Revenue Forecasting Committee for the roll-up costs for education in this from 0305 to 0507.
Essentially a no-cuts number.
That's right.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that also that number was selected. Actually, it was crafted in response to people's concerns that no matter what number we came up with, it wouldn't provide enough in the out years to keep pace. And the two, and I hate to use the term hydraulic, everybody uses it. Raising the base was what we tried to respond to people. And that, I think, also, the other end of that equation is what is the percentage number? Is it 51? Is it 53? Is it, as Mr. Hunziker offered, better based at 55? And I hope that what we do in this committee and on the Senate floor is fix the numbers and send it back. To have the debate that has to occur, not just in one chamber, but between the two chambers. Madam Chair, two other. The bill before us is 51 and 9 as the two percentage points. The bill, the minority report that we offered was 53% and 9. And Mr. Hunziker is suggesting 55 and 10. And I'm just wanting people to have a clarity in terms of what those brackets look like and where the compromises might occur. Madam Chair, just one other question for these three gentlemen. John Marshall, you're kind of a fixture in this place, and I say that in my mind I have the picture of the rusting pipes in the old wing of the building. But how long have you been at this process? If you could just give me the number of years you've been involved in helping people solve education problems.
My first session for the School Boards Association was 1983.
And before that, you were?
I was supporting the tax research for 5 years previous to that.
Okay. So the aggregate, do the math. What's the aggregate in the in this process?
28.
Okay. Mr. Lammy?
I've only lived in Oregon for 10 years, so four or five bang.
Right. But you, prior to the time that you came to Oregon, what was your profession?
Do I have to say it out loud? 36 years in education. 15 years a teacher, principal, curriculum coordinator, superintendent.
Okay. And involved in crafting budgets management?
For 25 years.
And I know some of Mr. Hunsaker's checkered career. I encountered him first as he was the superintendent of schools at Cresswell and followed his career at Bethel and watched him succeed in imposing a business model at Bethel that hadn't existed before, and advised him strongly against taking the position he now occupies. Mr. Hunsaker, do you what's your aggregate experience here?
36 years in education, 25 as a superintendent, and 2 years as COSA's executive director.
There's an aggregate of over 100 years of experience, just for the record, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Marshall, one last question. Is your organization supporting $5.318 billion for schools out of the general fund this session? Are you guys advocating for that?
Absolutely. We've consistently supported the highest number possible, including the 5.325 that's passed the Senate, and including the $5.4 billion that was proposed early on by some members of your office.
Great.
4-6.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us today. Next up, Andy Jordan, Catherine Firestone, Tricia Smith. Oh, sorry. Okay. Apparently, Ms. Jordan couldn't join us, or she had to leave. She submitted written testimony. We'll take that for the record. Ms. Chris Coughlin from our Oregon Coalition had to leave as well. So let's bring up Lori Wimmer Whalen, and then we've got Tim Nesbitt as well. And Marcia Kelly still in the room. We lost her. Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't see you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Catherine Firestone, Executive Director of the Coalition for Schools. I'm here today to oppose the Speaker's Stability Plan, House Bill 2450. As you may be aware, the Coalition is actively pursuing long-term strategic means to solve the school funding crisis in Oregon. While a plan that would guarantee that districts would be able to count on certain revenues from biennium to biennium would seem to be part of that effort, we believe this plan is flawed for two reasons. First, while there is a decided need to provide stability in our school funding system, it must be matched by adequate resources. 51% of the personal income tax is nowhere near appropriate to providing necessary funds for K-12 education. Historically, as you've heard, that range has been 52 to 59%. As you noted, Senator Brown, if the plan were in place today, we would have $329 million less in this biennium. In the current House proposal for school funding, the K-12 budget would be $5.16 billion, not the $5.22 billion that's proposed by the majority. There isn't anyone who can look at the actual figures and say that this is the right thing to do for our schools in the long run. At its most basic, it's bad policy to allow numbers to determine need. Rather, we should be operating under the assumption that need should dictate the numbers. This plan fails to allow for a changing landscape, whether continued pressure from high-need, costly student populations or increasing health insurance costs for staff. Secondly, it is a mistake to take corporate taxes out of the equation. While the amount of corporate taxes that contribute to the state school fund are negligible compared to the personal income tax, Oregon's businesses have a vested interest in seeing a strong public school system, and they should contribute commensurately. We believe that all segments of Oregon society should pay a fair share towards ensuring that our children have the education they need to grow up and become strong, responsible members of our community. On behalf of the Coalition, I urge this committee to forego any desire to tweak this plan and make it more palatable. By all means, all of us interested in a strong public school system must take an out-of-the-box look at what we're doing to ensure that we have adequate revenue for our schools and students, and the coalition is more than willing to assist in this effort. This plan, however, is too fatally flawed to be a starting point. We urge you instead to work towards passage of the Senate proposal for K-12 funding and return to the drawing board during the interim for other long-term strategic options for our schools. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Smith.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tricia Smith, representing Oregon School Board. Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents nearly 20,000 education professionals working in Oregon's education system, from our Head Start agencies through our community colleges. We're the classified and certified education professionals who perform every non-management function in our schools, from teachers and instructional assistants who directly teach our students to custodians, cooks, and bus drivers who make sure our children are safe and secure while they're in our charge. I'm speaking to you today to offer OSEA strong opposition to House Bill 2450. House Bill 2450 requires future legislatures to appropriate a predetermined percentage of future personal income tax revenues to the state school fund as the total revenues K-12 schools will receive from the state during a biennium. The bill's sponsor has said its purpose is to take the political discussion out of the state's appropriation to schools. We can understand that you might be tempted by the thought of eliminating the difficult decision of how much money to provide to schools and the accountability to the public that goes with that decision. We can understand you might think it might be easier for legislators in the future if their responsibility to provide adequate funding to schools is replaced by an arbitrary percentage decided by some legislature in the past. However, legislative ease does not translate to adequate education for our children, and that's the responsibility we believe that the public will not allow you or future legislators to set aside. In 2000, Oregon voters passed Ballot Measure 1, which enshrined in our Constitution the words, "The Legislative Assembly shall appropriate in each biennium a sum of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of public education meets quality goals established by law." And then it goes on to talk about the report that you are to write to show that you've done that. House Bill 2450 seems to us to be in clear conflict with the intent of this constitutional requirement to provide an adequate appropriation to schools by placing a limit on the appropriation based on a revenue estimate of just one of the state's funding sources. Changing the percentages and the limits in the bill will not alleviate this conflict. Other reasons exist for opposing House Bill 2450. Oregon schools have endured $800 million in cuts just since 2001, bringing us to historic lows in per pupil spending. This has happened even as our student population continues to grow, particularly with kids who have special needs. School children all over Oregon are doing without important programs too numerous to mention. We should be discussing the ways that we should be rebuilding our education system so that today's kids as well as tomorrow's will have the education that they need and deserve. Instead, House Bill 2450 would cement and repeat this historic low spending on education into every school year in the future, condemning every child to less education than he or she needs and deserves. I'd like to speak for just a second about the roll-up estimates in the bill at 9%. You haven't heard from Paul Warner yet, and I understand the speaker to ask you to hear from him. One of the things that he testified to in the House Budget Committee was that historic inflation in education is at 12%. The bill sets the inflationary increase at 9%. So whatever number you start with, you will be going backward every biennium under the current numbers. House Bill 2450 is also the most significant reduction in business support of education since Ballot Measure 5. Today, the state's share of school funding is a combination of personal income tax, corporate excise tax, and lottery funds. House Bill 2450 would shift that responsibility exclusively onto the shoulders of small businesses and individual taxpayers that pay the personal income tax. And that's just not fair. Oregon voters directed that the lottery funds be used for education. House Bill 2450 ignores that mandate. House Bill 2450 also ignores the direction to states by President Bush and Congress to leave no child behind in their education system. NCLB requires that 100% of our children meet educational standards in the very near future. With the cuts to our education system that have already occurred and House Bill 2450's guarantee of inadequate funding in the future, only the lucky child will avoid being left behind in Oregon's crippled education system. Even if House Bill 2450 required an appropriation to K-12 schools that was adequate to meet the educational needs of our students, it would not solve our educational funding crisis because it ignores the rest of our education system, including pre-kindergarten Head Start, community colleges, and our university system. To pluck a piece of education out of this mix and fund only that piece while ignoring the others will not provide our students with the skills and abilities that they need to succeed in the world of our future. This piecemeal approach makes no sense from a quality or a reliability standpoint. And finally, we believe the reason it's difficult for the legislature to make its appropriation to the K-12 school system without a lot of political heat is the same reason it's difficult for you to fund human services or corrections. We simply have an inadequate revenue system to meet the needs of the state. House Bill 2450 does nothing to solve that problem. So I'd like to end my testimony by pointing to another section of our Constitution, an article that Senator Gordley likes to remind us of. Article 9, Section 2 states, "The Legislative Assembly shall provide for raising revenues sufficiently to defray the expenses of the state for each fiscal year, and also a sufficient sum to pay the interest on the state debt, if there be any." House Bill 2450 does nothing to help you meet your constitutional obligations, nor will it really alleviate any political heat you may receive from Oregonians concerned about the education of our children. And when we really think about it, isn't citizen involvement in this process an important component in good legislating? For all of these reasons, we ask you to table this bad idea about how future legislators should act, and instead move on with due diligence and speed to the real issue at hand, which is next biennium's budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. I've not been in this legislature 100 years. It just feels like it. Yeah. You have my written testimony, I think, and I won't read it to you. I'd like to start, however, by thanking the proponents of this bill, especially Speaker Minnis and Senator Gordley, for engaging on the subject of school funding. We agree with the Speaker that stability is an important issue, but as a subset of the most important issue, which is to our members, adequacy of school funding. Our members' aspirations are more than just managing to a number. We believe that this bill, as sent to the Senate, is not what its title suggests and is, in fact, a spending limit on schools that militates against solving this most critical issue. OEA further believes that tweaking the percentages, as some have suggested, is not adequate. It's not a sufficient fix to remedy the policy and structural flaws that we see in this bill. Before I get specific about our concerns, I'd also like to say for the record that our objections have never been about politics and partisanship. They have been and remain valid policy concerns about the future of public education funding in this state. And to underscore this, let me share with the committee that we did offer a four-page analysis of the substantive features of the bill and followed up with a set of amendments, which were rejected on the House side. Now, to the substance of our concerns. There are several structural aspects to this proposal that make the concept unpalatable to most education advocates, as I think you've heard. I'm dividing them into five areas: the diversity of resources, volatility, acknowledgement of cost drivers, the hydraulics, with apologies to Senator Farioli, of the plan as structured, and finally, the arguments about adequacy per se. I'd like to refer you to the back page of my testimony, in which I have a little pie chart at the bottom left-hand corner. That pie chart, the three wedges on there are the personal income tax, undedicated lottery funds, and corporate income tax and other resources. Those represent the current revenue streams to the state school fund that we've enjoyed. This proposal removes two of those pie wedges altogether for time and all eternity and shrinks the third. That's why we call this proposal a cut and cap. Now, I would argue with respect to diversifying resources that if you went to your investment counselor, you would not be counseled to constrict your investments. You would be counseled to diversify your holdings because that's how you guarantee a more stable and adequate return on your investments. This plan kind of violates that basic principle. Inflation. Acknowledgement of cost drivers means more than just the CPI, the inflation rate, because obviously we have student growth factors and others. The School Revenue Forecast Committee has been mentioned, and that number was in fact built into the base roll-up calculus for the plan for one biennium. Cost drivers often exceed inflation in education, as well as the actual inflation of particular items within the services and supplies categories for schools. For example, textbooks often far exceed the CPI because we're a captive market. And you've also heard about other aspects of the personnel side of the aisle of the balance sheet that also exceed the CPI. Well, student growth is another piece, and this bill is silent on that aspect as well. And in fact, 4.5% per annum, as you've heard others testify, has rarely, if ever, been the level of the growth factor for the school budgets from biennium to biennium in the last four decades that we looked at. I think it was 1 year in the 80s was the only time it was that low. So, again, this is why we are calling it a cut and cap for schools. We've got some sense there of that. Volatility. The personal income tax as a revenue source is, in fact, volatile. Anyone who looked through the five special sessions during the recent economic recession will tell you that that was a personal income tax-related recession. When people are out of work, they're not paying taxes. The capital gains tax was down. Those are personal income tax dollars. So tying it to that single source is not only not diversifying your assets, it's tying it to a wild horse in that barn. So in and of itself, that does not make this plan stable. Only the rainy day fund aspect does. We have a rainy day fund, and we can always talk about ways to capitalize that at a more rapid pace. But we wouldn't need the whole plan in order to do that piece. There's also political volatility, and by that I mean every time we pass a tax cut proposal in this legislature, we are in effect reducing the revenues, and that's in part why corporate revenues have declined as a percentage of the general fund over time. I would point out to you that the maker of this proposal, House Bill 2450, was also a supporter of a significant 50% reduction in the capital gains rate, which is in the Senate's possession right now. It's House Bill 2332. Were both of those in effect at the same time, needless to say, the personal income tax revenue would be significantly reduced under this bill and that. Fourth, the hydraulics of this plan. This is what I call the can't-have-it-both-ways department. If you want to make the adequacy side more palatable, you beef up the percentage from 51 to 55 or what have you. But what you do when you do that is you reduce the amount of money going into the rainy day fund, which makes the proposal stable. If you put more money into the stability side, you diminish your adequacy side. One militates against the other in this bill. Finally, with respect to harming adequacy, I've heard said several times that the 07-09 school funding number would be approximately $5.8 billion for K-12 in the state school fund were this plan in place. Well, that's kind of damning it with faint praise, actually. If you look at the rate the 1999 legislature funded K-12 and just roll that up for those cost drivers that I've mentioned, we'd be funding K-12 in 07-09 at $7 billion. So that's a $1.2 billion gap. And I mention that not because I think that this state is well poised to be able to do that and fund all other programs adequately unless we have another bubble, but because we have been cutting $800 million out of K-12 in the last 4 years, and we do nothing to try to build back those programs, restore them, before we begin to launch from a base and fund for the future. So by putting schools on autopilot at a historically low level, we immortalize those 4 years of cuts. And I would argue that that's not even, again, that's not looking at the quality education model and seeing how far we are from funding it. That's looking just at a CSL roll-up from 99 when we had, I think, the same ambitions we have for outcomes for the students of tomorrow that we did then. We just don't have the cash on hand to fund those programs. So second-guessing your future colleagues by immortalizing cuts and locking in a specific rate, and I do think it's a specific rate because if it were a floor, as one of the previous testifiers said, it would have said not less than 51%. It did not, and we did suggest that. It does not say that. It says that percent and not less than. And also you have the LC opinion that backs up my contention there. I would argue that because we have mandates that are underfunded from the federal government, such as the Individuals with Disability in Education Act and the No Child Left Behind law, we have the obligation as a state to do better tomorrow for the students of today. And this plan has no such aspirations because it deals only with, as I said, the subset of adequacy that is the stability piece. The Senate, by contrast, has passed a package of bills that we think are very good beginnings and meaningful education policy this session. And for that, the Oregon Education Association and its 43,000 members are very grateful. Passage of this bill, however, would not add to that long list of accomplishments. We believe that cutting and capping school funding and then putting the budgets essentially on autopilot for the future is the wrong way to address the critical issue of school funding. We urge you not to pass 2450 to the floor, tweaked or unvarnished, and we welcome the opportunity to continue our mutual search for meaningful and workable solutions for the long-term health of Oregon's public education system. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the panel? Senator Ringa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just thank Ms. Firestone for coming today and ask you a couple of questions, if I could. How long have you been in education?
I've been an advocate for public schools in Oregon since 1991, primarily as a volunteer.
And you were the head of the PTA?
I'm past president of the Oregon PTA, past vice president for legislation for them, and I'm a former commissioner of the quality education model as well as a best practices panel member.
All right. Well, I just want to thank you for being an education champion. And I know that certain organizations didn't endorse you last election cycle. And I think that for some of us, those that calls into question the credibility of those organizations. But I just want to thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Senator.
Further questions from the panel?
Just thanks.
Thank you, Senator Schmidt. Thank you. Marcia Kelly.
I have testimony for Chris Coughlin for the Oregon Coalition. She left it with me this morning.
Thank you. The staff will distribute that to the members.
Chair Ferrioli, Vice Chair Ferrioli, and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the American Association of University Women of Oregon. We currently have about 2,000 members in the state. Our membership required until 10 days ago a baccalaureate degree from a university, no matter whether you're a male or a female. We did change that requirement at our latest convention to recognize the importance of community colleges and other higher education, and it has now been changed to an associate degree. So we're well on the way to encouraging all forms of education. AUW in Oregon for many, many years supported only one thing at the state legislature, and that was state-mandated kindergarten. After approximately 40 to 50 years of the one issue, we have expanded, but I find myself now back advocating for education. We're here in opposition to House Bill 2450 because while the premise of stable funding for education is good, House Bill 2450 will not create the reality of stable and adequate funding. Not only does it not create stable and adequate funding for the K-12 system, it does not speak to the other important aspects of our education system. In the 2003-05 budget cycle, we served only 60% of the eligible Oregon Head Start pre-kindergarten. Of those 60%, of all of the kids who were served, 74% of their parents were working either part or full time, but were at 100% or less of the poverty level. This is not even all the low-income kids, so how many kids are we leaving out by not adequately funding Head Start? We've also been underfunding our community college and university system. We continue to raise tuition, so it is becoming more difficult for low-income and moderate-income students to further their education. As our economy changes, education will continue to be important to a family's economic well-being. That brings us to the second reason we are not willing to support this bill. We are concerned that earnings by Oregonians will continue to deteriorate as there is a shift to a service economy. Many service jobs pay less than jobs requiring more education and skills. In addition, we see more women entering the workforce, and taxes will erode because women still make 25% about 25% less on average than men with the same education doing the same jobs. The third reason we oppose this bill is the shift to total dependence on the personal income tax. By shifting costs for K-12 to the personal income tax, you are taking away business's share of the common good funding. Business articulates the need for a well-educated workforce for their success, but by eliminating their participation in funding K-12, you give them a free ride. In fact, you could ultimately give them a reason to no longer do business in Oregon. If they can't find workers adequately trained, they will go somewhere else where they can find those workers. That brings us to our fourth reason we oppose this bill and any other bill that purports to set education funding at any certain level at this time. We oppose any set funding until we have true tax reform. We could fund many of the services we need for young children, K-12 education, and colleges at a higher level if we do not continually give away the store. You hear the business sector continually say how unfriendly Oregon's tax system is to business. We don't agree. The cost study of total state and local business taxes, a 50-state study of the taxes paid by businesses in fiscal year 2003, lists Oregon with one of the lowest business tax burdens in the country. In business taxes per dollar of private sector economic activity, Oregon is at 3.4%, with the U.S. average at 4.8. Oregon ranks 50th. In business taxes per dollar of capital income, Oregon is at 8.7%. The U.S. average is 15.6%, and Oregon's rank is 50. In business taxes per employee, Oregon ranks 49. In business share of all state and local taxes, Oregon ranks 48. This study is performed by the Council on State Taxation, that is a nonprofit trade organization in Washington, D.C. It was originally formed as an advisory committee to the Council of State Chambers of Commerce and has an independent membership of 550 major corporations engaged in interstate and international business, not exactly a liberal think tank. In the infamous tax expenditure book, we also show that 48 of the 48 business tax breaks that have been doled out have been doled out since 1980. How much do we have to give away before we can no longer serve our kids, our next generation, and the people who will be taking care of us in old age? Currently, corporations pay 71% or less of their share of the taxes that they did in 1970. AUW of Oregon wants stable school funding. We just don't want it to masquerade as stable funding by putting the entire burden on the personal income tax. We want real tax reform, that includes all forms of taxation. We want leadership for such tax reform so that we can fund the interdependent services that make a child ready for school, able to succeed in school, and have the chance at higher education, no matter what the child's socioeconomic interest. And without tax reform, we don't think that's possible, because we are continually undercutting the human services budgets as well as the education budgets. We will oppose any quick fixes because they are just that. Proponents of this legislation have said, this is just the baseline. This doesn't mean that we can't come back for particular parts of school funding that are problematic with other legislative monetary requests. And I think you've heard two of those today with the articulation of the PERS, rates, and the insurance. So the issue of school funding doesn't go away in 2007 because this will take the politics out. I don't think you're going to get the politics taken out of school funding. I've been off and on advocating in this building since 1975, so that's 30 years, so we'll chalk up 30 years for this. You need to address our system in its entirety to fulfill your constitutional obligations. AUW of Oregon wants all Oregon kids to have a chance to succeed. We don't see House Bill 2450 giving them that chance. We thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we oppose this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Kelly, questions from the committee? Senator Shields.
Do we have your testimony in writing?
No, you don't. I found a couple of errors in my prepared written testimony. I was writing it at 6 o'clock this morning, and I will have some for you tomorrow.
Please.
Thank you. Senator Shields, we will. If you'll bring that or email it to staff, they'll distribute it to the members. Thank you. I'd like to call Jim Cravens along with Mr. Nesbitt for the final panel of the day. Mr. Nesbitt.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, speaking for the AFL-CIO in Oregon. And I'm going to keep my remarks very brief. Having heard the testimony from those who preceded me, I think everything's been said, even if you've yet to hear me say it. So I will just note that I think finding a way to guarantee adequate and stable funding for schools has been the holy grail of this assembly. So it's no surprise that it's consumed centuries of effort from those in this room, as you've also heard from the prior testimony. And we do appreciate every effort to achieve that goal. But we cannot support House Bill 2450. And again, I think those who spoke before me kind of captured the reasons why. I would just add this perspective, and it's the perspective of a parent of a school child who started school first grade in 1990. The year Measure 5 passed, and whoever every year thereafter saw her classes get larger and her textbooks get older. And, you know, we were on kind of a down staircase then, because as you remember, Measure 5 kept phasing in reductions in the property tax, and the state kept finding the money to kind of curb to backfill those reductions. And we kept going down the staircase. And by 1997, when the staircase was supposed to have leveled off, then we got hit with Measure 47, and we had to again start backfilling the losses. It wasn't until 1999 that we managed to regain some level of stable school funding, at least for that one biennium. We started to step back up that down staircase. And by the way, when you look back over the last 10 years, it was in 1999 when actually our allocation was the smallest percentage of the last 10 years in terms of the personal income tax. It was only 52.3%. So pegging our contributions to school funding to attempt to kind of regain, to climb back up the down staircase, I think by pegging it to the personal income tax, we can go awry in that. I think we should be talking about a number, and the numbers we need to peg to get back up the down staircase. And it probably shouldn't be done as a percentage of the personal income tax, but more as a commitment to our schools based on the number of students we expect to enroll, the cost of a high-quality teaching experience, the size of our classrooms, and those other things, which I think you're better able to determine every year when you sit down and do the budget as opposed to what a formula will tell you to do. Now, we're not opposed to saying, here ought to be the next minimum step up. We're going to climb back up that staircase. And that would be a number in 07, 09. But I don't think, again, that you will be well served by establishing a formula based on a percent of a volatile tax, which is going to be a jagged line if you look at it. We need to make those commitments. It's going to be a multi-year effort, no doubt, to get back to even what we had in 1989 or the years that followed just before Measure 5 passed. But I think that's the kind of effort we should be making, and I don't think we should get sidetracked into a formula of this kind. Thank you.
Question for Mr. Murphy? Thank you. Mr. Cravens?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. We do not have a firm position one way or the other on House Bill 2450. I just wanted to make a couple comments after listening to today's testimony. I think people of good faith can differ on this interpretation, but I think you've heard from many witnesses today sort of fairly blanket statements that somehow this bill absolves corporate Oregon from any responsibility to pay for schools, a free ride for business, that kind of rhetoric. I mean, if you look at the bill itself or Mr. Hendricks' letter to Representative Merkley, I think what the bill, whether it's the right thing to do or not, what the bill says is that you shall allocate a total amount of money that is equal to 51% of the projected personal income tax revenues for that biennium. I think this is a way to set a target. It is a formula, as Mr. Nesbitt pointed out, arbitrary or not. The idea somehow that this is a way to pick a number that is equal to 51% of the projected personal income tax. To sort of take the next leap and say that somehow corporate taxes won't pay for education, I think is... While I do believe good people could differ on that, perhaps a rhetorical leap that maybe isn't justified in what is at the heart of the speaker's plan. All money, as we know in this building, gets fungible at some point. This would say a certain target is not fungible, but whether or not to say that corporate tax revenue would not be used to fund education because a formula generates a number based on 51% of another number, I think is maybe an unwarranted leap. And then my only other comment is that, you know, we stress over and over in this building, well, those are the only taxes from personal income taxpayers as opposed from business. Just to remind you, where do they come from? Where do the personal income tax revenues come from? They come from a business or a government paying an individual to do a task. And just speaking on behalf of the industry that I represent, whose average wage is twice the average private wage for the state of Oregon, our 80,000-plus members on average make twice what an average private sector employee makes in this state. You would think in some ways, until we do an overhaul, a fundamental overhaul of our tax system, a structure that encourages businesses to pay high wages to generate high personal income tax receipts from which someone gets a guaranteed 51% call, would be something people might be interested in looking at. So those are my only comments, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Question? Colleagues, we are in adjournment. Please note that we are posted for today at 3:30, same time, different set of subjects. Yes, Senator Shields?
The room will probably be locked. We could leave our bills here.
I think staff will be here working diligently.
Okay.
We're in adjournment.